after seven, time for Correspondence Report. Good morning to you, Elizabeth Jackson.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome. Our North America correspondent, Lisa Miller, has spent her last week at the ABC Bureau in Washington. After two stints totalling almost 9 years, Lisa is heading to the ABC Bureau in London. She really has contributed an impressive body of work. So I caught up with Lisa and we took a stroll down memory lane. Lisa Miller, welcome to Correspondence Report. Now, you started your first posting in Washington just months after September 11, 2001. Were you nervous about moving to the US to live?
Once I got there, you felt the tension in Washington, the fighter jets, the F-16s circling over the city, the fact that people would talk about their experiences about September 11 and would visibly shake still talking about it. So you couldn't help but absorb that kind of fear. There was one episode that lasted for a month or so where we were warned that if there was a biochemical attack, that we should seal the windows with duct tape and plastic. And we went out to do that because most of America was emptying the shelves of hardware stores. There was just this constant feeling that something else was about to happen.
10 years later, on the anniversary, in fact, you filed this beautiful piece to CR. It needs a little backgrounding. This is the Colasandy family, whom you first met just 1 year after September 11, but you went back on the 10th anniversary to see how they were doing.
And she made a lot of friends.
No, don't say stuff like that. That's annoying.
And we met her advisor.
Another school day over, and Lauren and Cara Colasandy are sharing some quiet time with their mum, Kelly, in the kitchen of their West Village apartment.
Your sister's so cute.
Well, and she was with Marvin.
But soon there's homework to be done. And tonight, for Lauren, it involves another rehearsal.
Cynthia Marie Lise Connolly. James Lee Connor. Kevin Patrick Connors.
These are the names of people who died on 9/11. She'll read them on the anniversary and finish with the name of her dad.
And my father, Christopher Michael Colasanti.
Okay,
don't read it
through that.
So slow.
Don't rush through that one.
Because you just sound weird.
Can you just do it again one more time?
Okay.
Chris Colasanti was a 33-year-old stockbroker who'd been with Cantor Fitzgerald for a decade before he went to work on September 11, 2001 and never came home. He left behind a shattered widow and two young children. Cara was five when he died.
As I leave the room sometimes, like, the teachers will be like, everyone be nice to Cara, her dad died on 9/11 when it's close to the anniversary. I don't think that that's necessary, though. And they also often, like, pull me aside for chats. Like, do you think you'll be okay? And the answer is always yes, and I always am okay. I don't cry.
I met them in 2002 at their home in Hoboken, New Jersey, when I was first working in the United States for the ABC. This New Jersey commuter town lost more of its residents than any other last September, one out of every 1,000.
You know, just looking at the skyline every day and having, you know, these two massive twin buildings gone, it's such a, you know, just a constant reminder.
Look at me. I don't want paint all over you. Ah. Lauren thinks if she doesn't look at me that, you know, I don't really stay.
Almost a decade on, and life has changed a bit. They've moved into Manhattan and can honestly say they're happy. They can even have a laugh when I play them the original story.
Look at all those pictures on
there. Look how big my forehead was.
I do.
Someone needs a nap.
No, look at me.
Hey, that's me.
Kelly Colasanti has spent the decade determined to bring up two happy daughters.
You know, I did. I was very worried, but they've probably been the easiest part. You know, easy and smart and kind, and yeah, they're happy. It's probably the conflicting, you know, two things of I'm proud and I'm sad that Chris didn't get to be here with them and me.
She never had much time for talk of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she wasn't moved when Osama bin Laden was killed, believing US intelligence failures were as much to blame for her husband's death as the Al-Qaeda leader himself.
Well, I was sleeping. I think it came out 10 or 11 o'clock here, and the girls were awake, and they each came into my room separately to tell me, which so it meant something to them, which kind of surprised me.
She turns 43 next month, and while she hasn't remarried, she has a feeling this anniversary, the 10th, is going to be an important turning point in her life.
I think I kind of said 10 years, you know, not that I'm going to, you know, give up grieving, but that would be a good number and the correct for myself and Chris. So I'm thinking it's going to be a turning point. I'm going to move forward in a different way, but time will tell, and you know.
It's not often in journalism we get to revisit places and people we've met before. Too often we breeze in and out of their lives, moving on to the next big story, leaving them behind. So it was a treat to track down Kelly and her daughters and discover the years had treated them well, that they all hold a sense of hope and excitement about the future and weren't derailed by such a devastating loss. This is Lisa Miller in New York for Correspondence Report.
It's true, isn't it, Lisa? You don't often get to go back and check in on people.
No, and sometimes it's just a matter of us being busy and moving on to big other stories. In fact, it took me almost all year to find Kelly and her family. I started the process 10 months before the anniversary by sending her a letter to the old address where I'd first met her. And I then tried a whole lot of other ways, including social media and various support groups. But that letter over the 10 months made its way from redirected address to redirected address, and it finally landed in Kelly's hands, and she contacted me. That particular anniversary and meeting up with Kelly, I was very grateful to her because she actually came back into my life at a time when I was going through great sadness because we had all just lost some very close friends in the helicopter crash at the ABC, and we were all feeling grief and sadness, and Kelly put her arm around me and told me that things were going to be okay. And she was evidence of it, that here she was with these two daughters and she had found a way to find happiness again. I love this job so much, but it is all about the people that we are meeting, the places we get to go to, and the wonderful inspiration that they can offer us.
Were you inspired by Castro?
That was a funny story. In 2002, we went to Cuba for a foreign correspondent, and we tried to track him down for days, and eventually we caught up with him at a trade show, and our producer, Vivian Altman, could speak Spanish, and so I remember my great effort for the interview that we had with the Cuban president was saying El Comandante, and we are Australian, and that was about it. And then Vivian took over, and we managed to get about six questions from him. I think I was so stunned at the time that we'd managed to find him and that he was going to speak to us that I have a photo from that era. I still look at it and think, did I really get that close to Castro?
When you returned to Washington for your second posting in 2009, of course, the recession dominated the news. Do you remember that time?
Well, I do, because unemployment was skyrocketing. And what I noticed from that period is such a change to the America that I had seen years earlier. Even just anecdotally, the number of homeless people that I see on the street as I walk to work. Today, one of them called out to me and he said, "Before you drown me out, help me out." And it really stuck in my mind because I thought he's so used to people just walking by and drowning out his pleas. And I turned around and gave him some money. I normally try and donate to food banks and the like, but it just struck me yet again that there are so many people who are in need in this country, the richest country on this planet, and the gap between those in need and those who have it is widening.
Now, in January 2010, Haiti, of course, was hit by the mother of all earthquakes, and you spent a lot of time reporting from a ship just off the coast. But in this Q&A with Eleanor Hall, you accompanied some Marines who were delivering aid supplies to Liaogang, which was close to the epicentre of the first quake. Let's just have a listen to that.
All you see as you fly in, Eleanor, are tents and people out on the streets. And we've landed in this cow paddock that has been secured by the Marines.
Aid distribution is finally becoming effective there. What is that meaning for the people?
Well, they're still actually quite frustrated, Eleanor, because they're waiting here with the Marines, but the Marines are getting the food and water in and then immediately giving it to the UN, who are taking it into the town. They're using interpreters to try and get the crowd away because they started trying to come onto this helicopter landing pad, but no matter what they say to them, to stay away and that food and water is available in town, they're refusing to go. They're just so hungry and thirsty. I've spoken to a couple of them who speak English, and they say they're not going to leave because they think this is their only chance to actually get their hands on the first lot of supplies.
An extraordinary situation to find yourself in, Lisa, surrounded by hundreds of starving, thirsty people, and you're sort of powerless to do anything.
And it had been on one of the trips as we were flying in, they were actually reaching up. You know, the helicopter hadn't even landed and they were trying to toss out the water from the back, as you often see with in rescue situations. And they were trying to reach up and climb onto the helicopter while it's still a few feet in the air. So it was quite a tense, dangerous situation. I can remember the Marines having to be cruel, almost like standing on their hands to make them let go, to drop off the back of the helicopter, because, you know, it would have been the worst situation if the chopper had crashed, if these people had been hurt, if they'd managed to climb up onto the chopper and then they're not secured. I mean, it was that you could see the look on the Marines' faces. This was not a situation they wanted to be in, because they wanted to be there delivering this food and water, and they were not ready for what was going to greet them. And in fact, the policy and the technique of the food and water delivery changed that night.
Now, one of the saddest stories for you, Lisa, I suspect, was the Sandy Hook massacre, 20 tiny kids gunned down in their classrooms. And you have spoken about this since then. Here's some of what you had to say.
When I heard about the massacre and the number of children who'd been killed, I was actually at Reagan National Airport in Washington covering another story with our cameraman, and we just immediately bolted and got up there to Connecticut pretty quickly. 20 children and 6 adults were murdered at the Sandy Hook School on December the 14th, 2012. It's really hard to find out exactly what is going on. In those first few crucial hours, it was almost impossible. I was standing outside the fire station where parents were still being told that their children were never going to come home. We stood there in the snow. The Christmas tree was up. There were stars and angels hanging from the Christmas tree. People had lights in their front yard saying peace, love, faith, and yet half a block away, 20 tiny children had been murdered. And I found it very difficult not to think of my own nieces, who are about that age. And after I'd been going for about 20 hours reporting, I started seeing their faces flash in front of me, imagining that they were lying on the floor in that schoolroom. And it was very difficult to not break down on air at times. I don't ever want to do a story like that again. I hope I never do a story like that again. And it has dogged me all year. I think about it quite often. I've often thought about the mother, Veronique Posner, who spoke to us. She was so brave.
His life energy, his appetite for life, he was a bon vivant. You know, he really enjoyed food and and companionship, and he was very engaged in life. I think he had a lot to teach everyone about being connected.
The gun used to kill most of the children and teachers was the AR-15. It can fire more than 50 rounds a minute.
They are weapons of mass carnage that are designed for the battlefield. It just has no place in society as I see it.
Veronique Posner, the mother of 5-year-old Noah, who was killed at Sandy Hook. Do you still think about Veronique, Lisa?
Oh, I do. I knew that we were going to be talking, so I am not in contact with Veronique. I'd like to be, but I have reached out to her and she doesn't want to be in contact, and that's absolutely her right, and I totally respect that. Her son Noah was 6, and you know, he had been shot 11 times. She was the only parent who wanted an open casket so people could see what had happened to her son. All the anticipation and hope and ambition of the White House to change gun laws in the wake of Sandy Hook came to naught, really. I mean, there were some people who were hopeful, but in that report for Foreign Correspondent, we were pretty damning of what the chances were going to be, because you could sense even then that up against the NRA, even the emotional, stunning, speechless grief that 20 children's families were going through and the families of the 6 adults was not going to be enough to overcome the power of the NRA. I still think it's just one of the worst stories I've ever covered, and I still cannot think of how those families cope even now with having a vacant seat at their breakfast table every morning. But it was such a tiny town, Elizabeth. We talked about it at the time. You know, it was a little creek bed going through the town, one main street, and you were surrounded by grief, just surrounded by it.
Lisa, let's end on an upper. You've filed stories, lots of stories about music, and you've travelled extensively throughout the US to experience all different genres of music.
I can't play it very well, though.
You even went to Memphis. Of course you went to Memphis. And you met some pretty wild Elvis fans. Remember this?
Oh, yeah. The best kind of dress in black. But I've been so long and lonely
street and never While the Elvis industry churns on, those with personal memories count themselves lucky.
My son says, I'm still in love with Elvis. He says, his mother, if you don't quit acting like you're so in love with Elvis.
For Kay Wheeler, it's been the love of a lifetime.
Everybody loves Elvis. That's what this is all about.
She was the first president of his fan club and became one of a string of girlfriends.
I just turned the door and walked in. He was sitting there all by himself in the dressing room, you know, in front of a mirror, of course. And he saw me. I walked up and I just stood behind him, and he got up and he turned around and he walked over to me, and the nerve, and this is really happening. He runs his hand all the way down me like this, and he says, is that all you, baby? And I said, and my heart's beating 1,000 miles an hour. Yes. It was unbelievable. And a lot of fun for a teenage girl 17 years old.
That's a very funny story.
Isn't it delightful? Even a son saying, come on, Mum, let it go, decades and decades later. You know what else about that story, Elizabeth? It was one of those days where the rain clouds started coming in. We thought our filming was going to be ruined. We'd been at Graceland sort of walking through the place, and I still felt like I didn't quite have what I needed from that day of filming. And I noticed a woman crying while she was standing looking at the grave of Elvis, and I walked up to her when she came away from the grave and introduced myself, and here I was in Memphis in the US, and this woman says, oh, g'day love, I watch you on the television all the time. And she was from Australia, and
She had come all the way just to go to Graceland, and it was so perfect. It just topped off the day for us.
Lisa Miller, it's been a delight. Thank you. It's been an extraordinary nearly 9 years for you in Washington. Thank you for all your excellent work. Good luck, and we will look forward to hearing from you from London.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks.
That's all from the program this week. Back to you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Elizabeth. I'm now thinking from Galway to Graceland is filling my head. There you go, free association.